Here's a question from Nadar Anis. Some copywriters suggest revealing the offer in the beginning of a sales letter or ad, especially if it's very powerful or has a strong guarantee. Do you recommend that? And if so, when is that a good idea?
Excellent question. In an ad, often the offer is the main reason that you are running that ad. In a retail, for example, you always want to have the offer, which would include the price, right up there as part of or in adjacent to the picture and the headline. In direct mail, if you're selling a $500 course or something like that, you don't want to start out telling them, here's a $500 course right in the headline. What you want to do is really write an incredible headline and subhead, maybe a couple of subheads, and talk about the benefits that they're going to get if they read this letter and obtain the product and then sell the product, and really not reveal the price and the terms until the person is pretty well sold that that's what they want. In other words, that would come near the close and near the bid for action, talking about the price and the bonuses and if they're offering split payments and things of that type.
Okay. Barry, what was the most successful direct mail campaign in which you were involved? In your opinion, what contributed to its success and why was it successful? What steps did you take in creating it? Bob Porosky.
I've been fortunate to have had a number of pretty successful direct mail campaigns, but the first one, I think, was back when I was in the mail order business. It was my second job out of college in Chicago. I worked with this mail order company, Precision Equipment Company, and they sold industrial equipment by mail, mostly drop shipped, all over the United States. The owner of the business, Walter Hybe, who was a brilliant guy, he was a high school math teacher that started the business literally on his kitchen table. And when I joined him, it was a multi-million-dollar business. He realized that getting customers the first time was important, but once you had customers, the follow-up mailings, the back end, was really the sweet spot. So, understandably, he wanted to find a way to rapidly increase his customer list, his client list. Then he would send to those people his catalog more frequently. So we devised a plan. We were going to test out mailing jumbo postcards, each one with one product, at an incredibly attractive offer. We had a series of four of those, and over a seven-month period, we mailed out these jumbo postcards, all of them asking, these are not lead generation. Each of them had a cutout coupon and asked for payment, or the extension of credit, which mailing to businesses was a common way to do it, but asked for a specific order. In 7 months, we doubled the customer list that he had developed over the previous 9 years. So that really gave me a taste of how satisfying it is from a creative person's point of view to see your efforts and your words generate piles and piles of orders and accomplish a really major objective. More recently, ongoing, a very simple one-page letter that was originally written for furniture stores has since been adapted for other types of retail businesses and service businesses, would be what we call a preferred customer letter or a client reactivation letter. Simply one page, black ink on white paper, 50 cents in the mail, first class. It has consistently brought returns of from $8 to as much as $17.13 per letter mailed out.
Wow.
To customers. I don't know of any legal way to print money much faster than that.
Wow, that's incredible.
And that has been used by several hundred businesses all over the planet and continues to be used as we speak.
Here's a question from David of St. Petersburg, Florida. Barry, are there past successful advertising concepts that your father may have shared with you that are not being utilized in advertising today?
Well, that's an excellent question. Incidentally, St. Petersburg, my brother lives down there. Great area. I like it down there a lot. Well, my father never really shared concepts with me. He made his materials available for me to study, and of course I learned a lot at his knee growing up. This course includes some of the ads that I have actually written in the course, but I don't think he shared any hidden secrets that have not been published. The thing is that just about no advertising advertisers today outside of the direct response field are aware of or utilize 5% of them. So, again, somebody that understands this material can quickly learn to create by far and away the most effective ads in his or her category.
Okay. I got a question for you. At the very end of the course is a little baby sitting at the typewriter. Is that by any chance you or your brother?
I wish it was me because I'd be a lot younger than I am, but actually that's my son.
That's your son?
That's my son.
Wow.
Yep. He didn't go into advertising, but he grew up a terrific kid, and he's an investment banker now.
It's a great picture. It's a great last page of this course.
Yep.
A final few words to you who have accompanied me through this course. Very good.
Yeah. What it basically says is that most people doing ads are as unknowledgeable as that little baby.
Absolutely.
But there's no need for that to be the case.
Very good. Here's a question from James Kittington. Barry, I'm under the conviction that long copy can sell better than short copy under the appropriate circumstances. However, I've heard repeatedly, not only from marketers but CEOs as well, that when top-level executives get business letters, all they want is bullet points and brevity. What is your experience in writing letters to top-level executives, and when is it best to use short copy and long copy with this demographic?
That's a really good question. I think nobody really wants to read long letters unless the letter is solving an important problem for them. Top-level executives, of course, are extremely busy and safeguard every moment of their time. And I certainly wouldn't just send out a cold letter that's very long to a top executive. I think depending on what it is that you're trying to sell them determines to a large extent how long the letter should be. For instance, if you're trying to set an appointment where you would like to see them, there are a number of techniques, but a long letter would not be one that I would recommend. Often, when you're trying to reach the top-level executives, there's a fairly small number that you're trying to reach. You can do that by sending an expensive mailing, something perhaps in a large box that's going to get beyond his gatekeeper. An example from some years ago, the advertiser mailed the cover for an expensive chafing dish and told why they wanted to see the executive, and all the executive had to do was have his secretary return this card, and then when he came to see the executive, he would bring the chafing dish itself. Well, that was successful in breaking through the clutter, breaking through the barrier, and impressing the executive enough that a high percentage did respond, and salespeople were able to get in and make the personal visit. If you're trying to reach the top executives, you need to maybe step outside the box a little bit.
Okay, great. Here's a question, Barry, from another James. In the 40 years you've been in advertising and copywriting, what is the single biggest change you've seen, and how has that affected you and your clients?
I don't want to sound cynical because I'm not, but I think that the greatest change that I have seen is the deterioration of the selling quality of the messages themselves. We've seen back in the 50s, the whole big buzzword was image, image, image. And we used to say the best image is a cash register that is ringing constantly with happy, satisfied customers. In more recent years, with the advent of computers and graphic software programs and so on, in print advertising, there are an expanded use of graphic devices and things that actually cut down the communications quality of the ads, and a diminution of selling ideas and selling copy. And in the big national advertising, the emphasis to a large extent has been on brand building rather than on selling. You see it even, for instance, in the automobile industry, as I think we mentioned. Car makers, particularly American car makers, are in dire straits. And yet even in their national advertising, they do practically nothing to sell the vehicle or give reasons to go into the dealer. It's not helping their brands either.
Here's a question from Joseph Nicasio from Long Beach, California. Barry, beyond having an irresistible offer, it is my belief that what makes or breaks a sales letter is having a process that makes it easy for people to buy from us. What specific recommendations would you make to make the process super easy for the prospect to buy? Example, how can we get out of our own ways so that the reader has absolutely no obstacle in the purchasing process?
Well, that's an excellent observation, and I completely agree with the gentleman. By getting out of the way so the reader can complete the process, I think that it means that when the reader is ready to order, you make it very easy for him. He does not have to figure out what to do. For example, a good order form essentially restates the offer, what he's going to get, what it's going to cost, what the guarantee is. If it's a fairly expensive item, what the financing options are. So all the reader has to do is tick the appropriate box on the payment method that he or she wants to utilize. It can also mean providing ordering options to suit the convenience of the customer. Generally, I'm in favor of having multiple ordering options. For instance, it can be by mail. It can be by telephone, which can be answered 24/7. It can be by sending in a fax. It can be by going to a website and ordering. Payment options can be check with order or credit or debit card. And in an expensive item, breaking it up into split payments. Dan Kennedy has talked about in some of his experiences in the past selling to professionals, chiropractors, dentists, people like that, where some of them were pretty well maxed out on their credit cards. They greatly increase the number of sales by enabling people to split the total amount on as many as 3 or 4 credit cards. In other words, our job as sellers is to let the customer buy the way it's most convenient and easy for that customer to buy and not erect barriers.
There's been a lot of talk in the direct mail industry. Some people swear that if you only give the customer one way to order, preferably by telephone, that you increase the response compared to giving them multiple ways. Is there some research to back up that your dad did on ordering from direct mail, anything you could cite or remember?
Well, I think Gary Halbert has said, in his experience at least on some offers, that he's had the best results simply using an 800 telephone number. And he's cited reasons why, and that is that many people like to talk to another person, and of course they can do it any time of the day or night, and they don't have to find a pen or they don't have to go to any effort at all. They have to simply pick up their telephone and order. It also has the advantage of reducing indecision. Sometimes when there are too many options, people can't figure out which option they want to take, and so they take none. I think that applies more to when there's too many merchandise options rather than ordering options, however. Other than Gary's statement that in certain tests that he has run, the phone option being the only one is the best, I have not seen evidence that that is the case. But if you have a single product, it certainly would be one of the things you could test. None of us know the answers to everything, and that's why testing is so important. I would encourage you, if you're selling an expensive product or something like that, to experiment multiple ways of ordering versus the telephone.
That feeds right into this next question from Chris Wolfhook of Derby, Kansas. His question is, Barry, on the first mailing to a list, what would be the most important and useful item to split test? Is it the premise of the piece, the offer, price, or urgency, or something else? Thanks, Chris Wolfhook.
Well, let's hope that we've got the right list here. Sometimes you want to test list if it's something that's going to go to a great many people. If it's more of a niche product, there aren't a lot of lists available, and then you've got the list that you've got. It is what it is. Then as far as the most important things to split test, I think probably the first thing I would test would be the offer itself, and maybe the second thing would be the price of the offer. I think that's what I would test first, and then secondly, I would test price.
But you bring up something very important, and that is look at the list, your market.
Right.
And that probably takes precedence over both those.
In many cases, if your universe is small, you mail to everybody. There aren't lists to test. So you use the list that's available. What you do want to do is match your message to the list. You want to address the people and show that you have some kind of rapport or expertise or knowledge in the area that is compatible with those names that are on that list.
All right, I've got a question for you, a situation that I specifically have a question for. I have a list. The universe is probably about 10,000 names, and I have 5,000 names, and it's testing an offer for an information product to a group of stock market type investors. testers, and I want to test the list, what would you recommend the amount of names I should test? I want to test it as inexpensively as possible.
Let me see if I got it. There's a potential universe of 10,000.
Yep.
You already have?
I've got 5,000 because that was the minimum, but I don't want to mail out all 5,000.
You've rented the list.
Yes.
And the list is 5,000.
Right. How should I test how many that's going to give me some inclination of whether it's going to...
Well, a statistician might disagree with me. I think if you're going to test two different things or one, or the offer, or what is it you're going to...
Just, I've got a long copy sales letter, so I want to test the mailing piece.
Just test that one mailing piece.
Yes.
And have you mailed to this category before?
Not yet, no.
Are you trying to get a direct sale?
It's a direct sale. It's a $600 product. I can make money at 1%.
If you can get 1% on a cold list for a $600 product, you're doing really, really well. If that was the case, 1,000, 1% of that would be 10, if I'm...
Yeah, that's correct.
I would think then to minimize your testing cost, I would test 1,000. If I got one order, that would be statistically discouraging.
Right.
That would let you know that maybe there's some things you need to revise and then test again.
So 1,000 or 500? I mean, what about 500? I was thinking of testing 500.
500?
Yeah.
1% would be 5 orders then, is that right?
Yeah.
You could do that.
Okay, because I've heard to get a statistical sample of a list, you got to test 5,000.
They're talking about...
Big
list. A list with a huge universe.
Yeah, you're probably right.
You can't do that. Well, you can, but if the universe is 10,000, you can't spend all your money testing.
Let me ask you this. Would you test it in nth name geographically or just a geographic, like if I pulled out all the 500 names from the list in California? I mean,
is this a product that would sell nationally?
Yeah, nationally.
I would do every 10th one or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for the advice.
And you may find that certain regions are more receptive than others, but I think that's what I would do.
Do you know of what regions, just from your experience, are more receptive to... I guess it's specific.
Financial offers, I would think, where the money is.
Yeah, New York cities.
Probably.
Here's a question from John Palma of Seattle, Washington. Barry, my question is, how would someone go about being your shadow for 1 year to sit at your feet and truly learn from a master? Having studied a number of courses, I think the missing link to being a really great writer today is that we don't have a lot of opportunity to work and interact with someone on a daily basis to really learn not only the mechanics of copywriting and advertising, but the thinking nuances that goes on in the process of writing copy. I think of some of the greats in the past, and many times they worked in the same agencies together. You had interaction with your father as well. Regards, John Palma.
But the gentleman is absolutely correct. There is merit to associating with and bouncing ideas off of like-minded people. And that's the reason, in my opinion, for the success of a lot of boot camps, is you get a lot of bright people that are like-minded and have the same basic base. So each one knows what the other is talking about. And then the ideas are spark and they fly. And that's very, very helpful. It's very difficult when you're in isolation to keep motivated and to evaluate your own ideas and all that. The other thing is, if you are somewhat isolated, of course, is to listen to tapes, to read books, to study courses, to try to form some kind of a mastermind group of like-minded individuals. And if you're writing ads or direct mail for your own business and you have some doubts about it, you want some other expert opinion, many consultants, myself included, will do critiques by mail or by phone. Sometimes that's a pretty good idea.
Okay, here's another question from Clifford Ferguson of Kensington, Maryland. Barry, should a copywriter make claims about a product if it is included in the product literature, for example, a book, if there is no data to support the claim? Eugene Schwartz has argued that it is okay to make claims in an advertisement if the information comes from the book being advertised. If the claim seems dubious and there is no way to prove its merit, what are the ramifications if a customer challenges the claims after the product has been sold? Is the refund guarantee enough to stay out of the legal trouble, or should there be a disclaimer in the text? Many trading programs and systems are sold that require investments of time and money after the product is sold. If the program does not live up to its claims and the customer has invested much more money than the cost of the program or the book, is there an obligation to the copywriter or to the seller if the litigation occurs?
Well, I'm no legal eagle. I disclaim any attempt to be practicing law here. Generally, if you're a copywriter, in my opinion, you don't want to work for a client that you think is seriously ethically challenged. Just life is, for me anyway, is too short to deal with the kind of people that recently acquitted accused murderer Robert Blake referred to as commode scum. There are plenty of those kind of people selling or trying to sell expensive financial schemes and products. That said, if you believe you are dealing with a responsible and ethical advertiser, the copywriter has no obligation or no way really to test or do the research to validate the claims that are made in the book or the system or the manual that is being sold. And I think would feel that he could use those things that are in the product. Now, on financial products, of which I seem to receive many offers, perhaps and probably it is a law that they state very clearly that these are not actual results from my own account, but from dry trading or from reconstruction of the figures, because there are many variables. That needs to be clearly stated. It also should be clearly stated that even if the individual selling the material has achieved these results, in real time, in actuality, that there's risk involved in any kind of an investment. And clearly the author cannot guarantee your results. You may make money, you may lose money. So you want to cover your bases, and anybody advertising financial products or products claiming to be able to show somebody how to make a ton of money should be very careful to know the law and be in compliance with it. Now, not being a lawyer and not wanting to offer legal advice, that's just the best opinion that I can offer.
Okay, great. Couple more questions. Here's one from Craig Cherry of Lusby, Maryland. Barry, how do you determine where in a piece of copy to place each type of information?
I think the way that's done is that you follow an outline, or basically the skeleton. For example, you want to have all of the elements that are to go into the mailing piece listed so that you have a list of all of the things that have to go in there. You want to have made up a list of all of the features or the product benefits. You want to have established a list of all of the benefits, and you want to kind of arrange those in descending order so that you emphasize the strongest ones that are going to appeal to the greatest number of the readers. Then you follow a traditional formula, attention. How are we going to attract attention? Well, you attract attention through headline and illustration, and you move through the desire, and you use the copy and information to hone and whet desire, and you go right on through. I guess I left out interest and desire. And then that is often left out is conviction, the believability factor. And you build that in, and then you build in action, the close, the call to action, the time where the rubber hits the road.
Okay, here's my question. Of all the copywriting formulas, you've got ADA, Attention, Interest, Desire, Action. You've got AIDPPC, that's Robert Collier, Attention, Interest, Description, Persuasion, Proof, Close. You've got Earl Buckley, IDCA, Interest, Desire, Conviction, Action. Victor Schwab, AAPPA, Attention, Advantage, Prove, Persuade, Action. Henry Hoke, PPPP, Picture, Promise, Prove, Push. Dan Kennedy, PAS, Problem, Amplify, Solve. Or any of the others, including Bedell. Guidepost. 1. Always say quickly the best thing you can say. 2. Follow a route. 3. Be lucid and clear. 4. Be believed. 5. Be complete. 6. Sell, sell, sell again. 7. Print it as clearly as you think it. Which two would you choose as the most effective way to plan a sales piece if your life depended on it and you only had 2 shots at it? Neil Phillips from the UK.
There's a great deal of merit in each of the ones that you mentioned. Certain elements, even though the words may be slightly different, appear in all of them. I believe the one that Clyde has, attention, interest, desire, conviction, which is missing from the AIDA formula, and action, pretty much provides room to incorporate all of the features of all of those other formulas. I appreciate the gentleman that asked that question. He says, you know, if your life depended on it. When I sit down to write an ad, even today, to get myself cranked up and into the mood, will say, if all the money I was going to make next month was going to come from this ad, what am I going to do to make this ad as strong as I possibly can? possibly can, because if it's not successful, I'm going to go hungry. With that framework in mind, you not only think about it and write the best headline, you don't write the headline once. You may write 10, 25 or more headlines before you come up with the one you want. In fact, I believe Brian Keith Voiles, who's a brilliant copywriter, one of the best, I think he says he writes as many as 250 headlines before he's satisfied. So you work on every aspect of that ad or letter to make it just as powerfully compelling as you can. Then you sit it down and you wait a day, and then you maybe read it aloud and see how it sounds. Finally, when you've done the absolute best that you possibly can, you go ahead and you run with it. Invariably, as soon as you've done that, you see it in print, you think, oh God, I could have fixed it up better even by doing this or that. But the basic thing is you want to be in the mindset that everything is riding on the success of this ad or mailing piece.
Well, you bring up Brian Keith Voiles, and I have a 2.5-hour interview with him up on my site, which he talks about how he creates headlines specifically. That's at hardtofindseminars.com, and it's also on my executiveaudioinstitute.com. It's an incredible interview.
Well, I know Brian, and I've heard one of his teleconference interviews, and I'm going to go to your site and listen to that one. He's a beautiful human being, and he's a real student of the business and is extraordinarily talented.
Okay, great. Well, that brings me to a question specifically. If you say you're getting ready to write an ad like your life depended on it, and you look at it in terms of all the money you had next month was going to depend on this ad, how important does your research come into before you write an ad for a client? How much preparation and research are you going to do? What's your process for doing that, I think, all-important step before you write a word of the ad?
Well, that's a very good point. You really need to do research to know who the target audience is. Who are we trying to reach here? Oftentimes, the client can provide pretty good information. Are you talking about if you're a copywriter going to do it for a client, or if you're in business going to do it for your own business?
Let's say you're a copywriter. You're going to produce advertising for a client.
For another client.
Yes. How do you do it? What's your process with the research?
I have developed a form that I require the client to fill out in some detail about his business, his product, and the customers that he wants to reach. I ask for samples of previous mailings. I ask for copies of testimonials. I ask for, in some cases, permission to actually speak directly with clients or customers to get their opinions, their reactions, to see exactly how they respond to what it is that makes them want to respond to this product. Do all of that. Perhaps look at trade journals if it's a business client. Get information about who the chief competitors are, how this product is superior, how it's priced in comparison with the other. Find out as much as I can. Then, with all that information, make my outline and lists of benefits and product points and so on.
Do you create your advertising by writing it out on paper, or do you type it?
I use the computer. Some people say, and it probably makes a lot of sense, for the first draft to just get a legal pad and write longhand, don't edit, just write. I know the basic order in which I want to present information, but I tend to do a semi-edit as I go along. And so I find doing it on the computer, for me, is a lot faster. I can transpose a paragraph real quickly that way, for example. I may make major adjustments as I go along, and then what I'll do is print it out, and then I'll begin to make adjustments with a pen, and then go back and make those adjustments and print it out again and try to read it in the form and as the target customer would read it.
What order will you do things? When will the headline come compared to the body copy?
Right. That's a good question. Some people say write the copy and then pick the headline out of the copy. I believe, and Clyde believed, that that's a very bad idea, because you want to start the ad with the very best-selling idea that you can. And then once you've got the favorable attention of your prospect, you don't want to change the subject and start talking about something else. You want to immediately expand on that which attracted the interest in the first place. Whereas if you pick the headline out of the body copy, what would follow is probably not what would be expanding on the headline. You change the subject, and nothing will turn somebody off faster than say, gosh, I'm really interested in starting to read and find that the subject is changed right away. So I strongly believe you start with the headline.
I've got another recording on my site. It's a remake of a Eugene Schwartz speech at hardtofindseminars.com. It's really incredible, and he talks about a very effective way and method in working is he uses an egg timer. And when he sits down and writes, he can do nothing but look at the screen and start to write. And he writes in increments of 33 minutes and 33 seconds at a time. That's all he does is write, or either looks at the screen, works with the copy, and he works in small segments like that. How do you handle when you're writing a piece? Do you work in small chunks? Do you take breaks? Do you knock it all out? And what time of day seems to be best for you when you write?
What you've just done is brilliant. The 33 minutes, 33 seconds. That's very interesting. I sometimes will do it for just 30 minutes because I find that breaking it into small bites where I'm required to sit there and not allow myself to get involved in anything else until that time period is up tends to work the best for me. Also, I think it helps to overcome writer's block, which all writers at some time or another have to experience. And if you're sitting there and that screen is in front of you and you know you're not going anywhere, you're not going to do a thing for 30 minutes, pretty soon you get tired looking at that blank white screen. And at the very least, you can begin to start writing headlines, even if they're completely off the track of what you're going to eventually end up with. Once you start that creative process flowing, then the dam is broken and it seems to come quite easily. I do feel it's important to, at least in my case, to have the discipline of being forced to focus.
Okay, here's another question, and this is from Marco Abtronte, I believe. He's from Italy. He says he's tried to contact you before, but he never heard back from you.
Well, that's not true, because he's bought a bunch of my stuff. Maybe he contacted you a while ago. I don't know.
Here's the question. My question is, Barry, what is the best and least expensive method to quickly increase sales in a slow economy? You know, money aren't so much during recessions, either for business owners and customers. A simple postcard, a sales letter with a brochure, a small classified ad for a 2 to 3 step process, an advertorial on a local newspaper. I know all four is the best, but with a budget of $2,000, I don't think it's possible. God bless you and yours, Marco.
Marco runs a mattress store in an Italian city of around 150,000, and he's an independent, and his location is far from the best, and he's got tough competition from national chains that run color ads. Some of them do television and are in better locations, so he's got a real struggle, and yet he's a good merchant and he's done quite well. The quickest way in a tough time, any time in my opinion, to generate revenue quickly is to go to your database, to your customer list, to construct a really attractive offer and mail it out to your customers. A lot of people on the internet can do that with an email, and if people have an e-zine can do it that way. A retail store, generally, it would be to send out a mailing to the customer list or information provider to go with a terrific offer to those that have already bought from you. In terms of the best media, I'm not sure that one media is any better than any others just because times are tough. In Marco's case, because he cannot afford television and he cannot afford great big newspaper ads, I have suggested to him that he, and he sells higher end products, by the way, that he develop a little consumer information type booklet on how to select the right mattress so that you will get the sleep that you want and wake up feeling good without a backache and so on, and offer that in small space ads, in effect using a 2-step process. Along with that booklet would come an attractive offer on his bedding. That isn't just for hard times or recession times, but I think it's an effective way when you're faced with the disadvantages of much more richly endowed competition. So I have given him that suggestion, and hopefully he'll follow through on something like that.
Okay, very good. All right, Barry, that wraps it up.
Hi, this is Michael Senoff with HardToFindSeminars.com. You have just listened to the end of my exclusive interview with Barry Bedell, the son of the great Clyde Bedell.